Today's episode is brought to you by Slate House Publishing, recorded at Wayne Howard Studios.
Hi, everybody. This is Jeremy. This is Slate House Publishing Presents Lit Bits. And with me, as always, is Trevor and Curtis. Say hello, guys.
Hello.
Hello, guys.
Thank you.
Did I do it right?
I think so, yeah. Today we're joined by Michael Kellermeyer as a co-host. He's the publisher, owner, editor, illustrator. You wear, like I said in the last episode, you wear a lot of hats.
Yes, I do.
Old Style Tales Press. And if you want to learn more about that, listen to our previous episode with Michael, where we really talk about that. He has some wonderful editions out there, and we really want you all to experience them. Today, I think... and trying to figure out how I want to package this episode, I think what I want to call it is like an introduction to Victorian ghost stories. And because we're not really going to, we're going to get pretty deep on a couple of stories, but this is just really the tip of the iceberg, I feel like. And there is such a world, just a huge wealth of information out there for Victorian literature and for Victorian horror and ghost stories, that what we're going to talk about today is just really just a taste for these stories. So if you like what you hear when we talk about these stories today, then by all means, check them out. Check out oldstyletales.com and see all of the, you've got like 35, you said, titles?
Yeah, 35.
All centered around this idea of like the weird fiction and ghost stories and stuff. So,
and I've some really good authors.
Some great authors
that I think like you can enjoy at any time in your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We did a hot take on our Patreon about how to get into horror literature. And I think one of the ideas was eventually getting into, or like for those who are like well-read, you know, for the people who are like English majors who maybe not have experienced a whole lot of horror literature, that the classics are a way to go. And I think the library that you've kind of already built into your catalog of books, I think is a great way to get introduced.
Well, and I think what works about that catalog for me is that, you know, again, there are some really well-known authors represented in here, but perhaps sometimes in lesser known spaces, you know, like Charles Dickens, I think, was master of the ghost story for a long time. Mm-hmm. He was like the de facto, you know, ghost story guy. And yet when we read his stuff today, we're not reading his ghost fiction, which I think is kind of a shame, because I think his ghost fiction is way more, for me, way more interesting.
Well, and the only ghost fiction of his that we do read or that we are aware of is A Christmas Carol.
And nobody remembers that that's a ghost story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, we talked about that on our Christmas episode. Yeah, yeah. The creepiness of the guy undoing his handkerchief that held his
bandage,
his jaw just kind of drops open. It's like
it's very, very gruesome. Yeah,
yeah. But I also like that your stuff actually also services like a lot of different, more obscure authors, or at least authors that would be more obscure by today's standard, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
And I feel like the two that we're looking at today kind of stretch that kind of spectrum, right?
Yeah.
So we have
they definitely do.
So one author we'll talk about, I should introduce them in the order that we're going to talk about them. Like I always tell my students, you know, make your thesis statements work. So the first author that we're going to talk about might be, I feel like a little less well known, Edith Nesbit.
I mean, in today's age.
And then the second author we're going to look at, M.R. James, I feel like has a little bit more.
He's much more well known.
Much more well known, even though to the layperson out there, they wouldn't know about either of them.
I think, probably. I think to an American audience anyway.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I feel like British audiences are still pretty well aware of M.R. James. His stuff, his stuff is still being adapted.
Yeah.
You know, within the last 30 years anyway, into, you know, short story or short film anthology stuff, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Edith Nesbit, not so much. Yeah. But I think that she is a bit more obscure for the 21st century reader.
By the way, I'm the layman in the room, so
yeah.
I'm always the sample. If you wondering who knows
audience
what.
Audience sample, yeah.
Yeah, just ask me.
I mean, so Curtis, have you heard of Edith Nesbit or M.R. James?
No.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah.
Well, I want then, I really hope to get Curtis's feedback on as we talk about these stories, because they're, man, that illustration you provide with the Edith Nesbitt story. Okay, let me get into it, because we got to, like, people are going to be like, well, what's the freaking story? So we got to talk about it. Mm. So Edith Nesbitt's The Mystery of the Semi-Detached is the first story we're going to tackle. Right. It's in your the mm-hmm. Best Victorian Ghost Stories annotated and illustrated edition. Yeah. I'll put that on our website as like one of our sources so people yeah. can find it.
Should we turn it over to the expert for a summary?
Yeah, let's turn it over to the expert for the summary.
That's you.
Okay. So essentially, as I'm pulling this up, what the story, how it starts is we've got a young gentleman who is loitering around the he's loitering around the outside of his girlfriend's apartment, and they've recently become supposedly engaged. You know, they've decided that they're going to get married, but her family is very against it. She doesn't, or they don't like the idea of her marrying this guy, and there's a suggestion that that he might not be a high quality person for her to be with, and that there's something about the relationship that's a little unsettling to them. You know, she has a widowed mother and a wealthy uncle who are you know, they're kind of trying to coach her through being a marriageable young woman during the late Victorian period. And so he's hanging outside of her apartment, which is a semi-detached, and the word that we would use in the United States is a duplex. You know, so it has a shared wall with another apartment, and it's really creepy the way it begins. It has this very atmospheric beginning where it's twilight, it's dusk. They have these the widowed mother and the uncle have agreed these guys can get together you know, once a week. They can see each other once a week, and they've decided we're going to meet outside of those parameters. So we're going to have a clandestine meeting where we get together. And he's, again, loitering outside of her apartment. It's getting darker. You know, it has this beautiful language where they say, you know, the cyclists were riding by like gray ghosts. You know, policeman passes him, and the policeman's kind of terse. And there's just this sense that there's something weird brooding around this neighborhood, which is in a very posh part of London. He looks up, and he realizes for the first time, oh my gosh, the door to her apartment is wide open, but there's no lights on inside. And so he's kind of concerned and decides to investigate, like, what's going on, because he's expected her to come out and meet him. He goes inside. The whole apartment is dark. And it should be noted, in this time period, this is where she lives with her mom. So this isn't her apartment. This is their shared apartment. You know, he explores the rooms. Everything's dark. Everything is gloomy, and there's a sense of tension that's just dripping over the whole story. And then he decides to go up the stairs. And the thing that always stands out to me, and this is one of those things about Victorian literature, is that can be confusing, is it's pretty significant that he, number one, knows to go up the stairs, and then number two, knows where her bedroom is.
Right.
Because that's the first thing he does is he goes up to her bedroom, and he's also very comfortable opening that door and walking into that bedroom.
Right.
Which these are things that we would not pick up on in a modern story or think were significant. He goes up the stairs, everything's cast in gloom, it's very dark, and he opens the door, and as he has been exploring these different rooms, trying to figure out why is the door open, where is everybody, he's been striking matches. So he strikes a match and holds it up, and he sees, you know, kind of the detritus of her life. There's ribbons and gloves, and there's stuff kind of, you know, it looks like it's been you know, that she's dressed or undressed recently, and there's stuff kind of flung around. And he looks up at the bed, and he sees her, which it's, this is an important plot piece. It is her. He sees his sweetheart, she says, in a loose white gown, which, you know, we're going to take that to mean negligee. She's wearing negligee in the bed with her throat cut ear to ear, and there's blood everywhere. He absolutely freaks out, books it out of there, drops the match, runs down the stairs, runs back into the policeman who had earlier kind of looked at him suspiciously. And he's actually so gobsmacked and so stunned and shocked that the policeman kind of drags him to not prison, but drags him to jail to sit in a drunk
tank.
They
think he's drunk.
Figure out what the situation is.
Yeah.
So the next morning, he expects, like, they let him out, and he runs back to the apartment, and he expects there to be a crowd kind of, like, ogling at this murder. And nothing's wrong. His sweetheart is there. The mom is there, and he can't really tell her. He doesn't want to tell her exactly what happened, but he's like, well, the door was open. I went inside, and, you know, I can't say what it was, but there was something in the bed that was just too much for me to handle. And so the one thing, they kind of talk about the details, and he's like, well, the one thing that did stand out to me was, you know, you had a date book on your wardrobe, and it was open to October 21st. And this is in May. And he's like, so that was kind of weird. And she's like, no, my date book is open to, you know, the current date. So I don't know what you're talking about. But he's so shocked by this vision, you know, just the sight of her with her throat cut in bed in a very violative way, in a way that's, like, very sexually charged. And he doesn't rest until, number one, she's moved out. And then Nesbitt says, and incidentally, he also married her. You know, so it's kind of,
right,
kind of funny.
Right, yeah.
Like, and in the process, he also ended up marrying her.
Yeah.
They move out to the suburbs away from this posh neighborhood, which is implied to have lots of, like, secrecy and lots of, like, you know, there's just stuff. This is a fashionable part of London, but there's a lot of stuff that goes on behind closed doors. And he, you know, gets her out to the suburbs. Mother-in-law moves in with them, and he keeps checking in on this apartment, like, hey, has anyone rented the semi-detached? Well, later in the summer, he finds out that an investment banker, I think it's a stockbroker, stockbroker has taken the place. And he tries to convince this guy, you know, without telling him exactly why, you need to leave. Like, you do not live in this apartment. It's not a good place to be. There's something wrong about this place.
It's always a convincing argument, right? When you're like, I can't tell you why.
Can't tell,
like,
you why. Dude, which is, let me explain, the same thing he did with his quote unquote fiance, where, right, you know, he never really told her what he saw.
Right.
But somehow he convinced her to get out. Well, you know, and then Nesbitt closes with this paragraph at the very, very end, where she says, the funny thing was that on the morning of October 22nd, you know, when his wife came down to see him in the morning, he was, you know, she found him with his head in his hands and a newspaper at his elbow. And she's like, what's wrong? And he just, you know, points to the newspaper, you know, very nervously. And then in the newspaper's a description of a murder that took place at that address, where the daughter of the stockbroker was found with her throat cut ear to ear in her bedroom.
Yeah.
And that's it. And that's the end of the story. And so, I mean, the name, The Mystery of the Semi-Detached, it's a really good name because it is a mystery, you know, like, she never resolves it. She never says who did it or why. And the thing is, that's not the point. You know, the point is not to look at, like, okay, who was the murderer? It's not a thriller so much as it is kind of a philosophical tome poem about just, you know, the lack of support that a person can have in life when your gut is telling you something, but, you know, fate has decided that this is something that can't be prevented. It's going to happen.
Right.
Yep.
I think that's an interesting allegorical point, because when I read these stories, right, one of the things that I really try to figure out is, like, what's the message here, right? Like, what seems to be the kind of human, not necessarily like human lesson, right? But in a way, like, what is the human lesson?
What's the point? Yeah.
Yeah. And I like this story because it's weird and it's trippy. It reminds me of another story I told Jeremy after I read it. It really reminds me of another story that was written, I think, in the 1950s by Julio Cortázar. He's a writer from Argentina. He wrote this short story called The Continuity of Parks. And the conceit behind The Continuity of Parks is there's this dude who lives a pretty simple life, and he just wants to get back to his apartment so he can read his book. And the book is like a murder mystery book. And he's like at this point where the two lovers are discussing who their next murder is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so he sits in his armchair with his back to the door, and he reads the book. And then all of a sudden, as he's reading the narrative of the book, it's describing the two lovers who are coming up for their next victim. And they charge into this room where Mr. Parks is reading his book, and they slip in and murder Mr. Parks, right? Huh.
Yeah.
So it's like this really weird kind of meta fictional narrative. And I don't know why there was a resonance in my brain between that and this story, which is also really short and seems to deal with, you know, somebody kind of foretelling the future, right? And
yeah,
not quite being able to know what that means or do anything about it, right? So I think in some ways, there's a lot of interplay with agency in this story.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And I think so in some of your annotations, you note like this sexually charged subtext here, right?
Yeah.
Like one, we know that these people are sleeping together. I mean, that's the whole point. If this were a John Hughes film, right, he'd be like waiting outside the lattice, you know, to like climb into the girl's room, right?
Yeah.
And so there's that dimension, but I think too, you know, about to your point about like the actual violence itself that we see, where her throat is slit ear to ear. And she's in her dressing gown, or she's in her, you know, her nightgown or whatever. I think that there is a vulnerability there that is sexual in subtext. Right.
Well, and looking at the date of the story, I mean, it would not have been lost to Nesbitt's readers the comparison to the Ripper murders that had just happened.
Yep. I was also going to ask
that's
that.
That's very true.
When was this
1893, is that right?
Okay. Yeah, 1893.
Yeah, it was just a few years after.
And when did the Ripper murders occur?
1888, I think.
Is that right?
I think so. We talked
1880s,
about it. Yeah, we talked about it in our Dracula series.
I mean, I think you're... the only reason is I'm asking is because I frequently, you know, kind of like miss things by like a year or two.
Yeah,
me
or something
too.
Like that.
Yeah.
But
it would have still been on their conscience.
My
think
thoughts were the same way because, you know, I think that the Ripper murders were like sensational, right? And when you read anything, I think.
I mean, we still talk about them to this day, so
right.
It's.
Well, and when you read anything, I think from the late 19th century, you know, the turn of the century, where we have a woman murdered with, you know, like horrific violence. I mean, in this case, her throat is cut ear to ear.
With those sexual overtones.
With those sexual overtones, right? It's really hard to get away from like, oh, okay, so this is kind of like the Ripper murder thing.
Yeah.
And it's really similar the way she's found, definitely harkens to like Mary Jane Kelly, the final victim who's found in her bed, whereas like the rest of them were all found, you know, in alleys and on the streets, but Mary Jane Kelly, you know, kind of the most famous Ripper victim just because of the ferocity
of
how she was killed, was found in her bed just like that by a guy with a bullseye lantern, you know, a policeman,
right? Which I think is I mean, the just the style of the murder is super intimate too. I mean, like the
yes,
the ear to ear, that's not something that's easy to do. You got to be real close to that person. The fact that it happened in her bedroom while she's in her bed is also extraordinarily intimate.
Well, and you mentioned too, Michael, you talk about how the Victorian audience wouldn't have been lost that the boyfriend knows where her bedroom is.
Mm-hmm.
To know that the killer would also know where her room is just that much more that amps the level of terror up, I think.
Yes. Yeah. And then there's all this like all this dualism of, you know, this unknown killer, whoever he was and whatever his situation was, versus the boyfriend, you know, and it's just, and that's kind of one of the big points of the story is, you know, that he kind of sees himself and what he's doing to her and what happens to this vision of her. And so, yeah, there's a lot of dualism in his role and what it is doing to her, in a different sense.
That's an, I hadn't even thought of that implication, you know, the dual role between this mm-hmm. guy who's, having improper relations, we can say, with this girl, and then, there's also this murderer who's, mm-hmm. Showing up in the same space.
But the horror writer in me loves the idea that it's something, the killer may not, this could be a prophetic vision where this was going to happen. But I love the idea that it's something in the house, a malicious spirit that is just waiting for that whoever's going to occupy it to mm-hmm. to kind of do this.
It's a trap.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't pick up on that subtext or that.
But see, that's where that's just where my mind goes when I read stuff like this. Mm-hmm. It's like something, because I'm into the supernatural horror, so it's.
Oh, sure, for sure, yeah. And this is very supernatural, right?
Yeah.
Like
at least the prophetic vision is,
you don't have prophetic visions of your girlfriend being dead, like 4 months from now, 5 months from now, or whatever. That's not a normal thing that people do.
Well, I didn't tell you about my dream last night, though, did I? No, I'm just kidding.
Jeremy's like, that's not normal?
What are you talking about? You don't say. So you're telling me I'm dreaming weird then. Lay off the melatonin, Jeremy.
Coming back to this theme of agency, right? I think that what works about this story for me is kind of the duality of that agency or the loss of agency, right? Mm-hmm. Because I think that for a lot of men anyway, right, at this point in time, there's not a same or a similar fear of a loss of agency, because it feels like, men, especially in Victorian England, right, hold a lot of power and hold a lot of power to act. Right. Whereas I think these extraordinarily violent murders against women, which have sexual connotations as well, what's so terrifying about that is that women do not have agency, right, mm-hmm. to change these things. And so his discovery in learning that his action cannot stop something from happening, right? Maybe he saves his girlfriend, then his wife, right?
Mm-hmm.
But this violence still happens, right? Regardless of his activity. I think there's a real horror mm-hmm. there, right? There's a real mm-hmm. kind of turning the agency against the man and making him feel powerless. And that mm-hmm. therein lies kind of the human question, right? The human problem is this concept of where is our agency? How do we mm-hmm. control our agency? And what do we do in a world that seems completely out of our control?
Yeah. And obviously, I think if you are a fan of Victorian ghost stories, you're going to think of Charles Dickens' The Signalman, which is a story about, it's a railroad worker who has these visions that preface a tragedy or a disaster, and he's never able to stop them. They just happen. And so it's like, why am I hearing about this if I can't stop it? Yes. And to your point, I almost think it's it's almost a turn of the screw, to use another reference, for this guy to be able to save his girlfriend, but not save the next person. Right. And he is not sitting there, you could have this story. And I think it's so much more human and powerful that he's devastated at the end of the story. And I think this is one of those things, which I think the last episode we touched on this, but female writers in the Victorian ghost story genre are just so good. And they have such a different perspective, because I do think that a male writer, he'd still be tore up, but he'd be like, oh, we dodged one.
Yes.
Yeah.
But there's a pathos to the ending, because he's almost just as devastated as if it was his girlfriend. Cause he's like, I couldn't stop it. He's super, his experience through this whole thing is very, to kind of point out the gender elements here, it's very emasculating. He's completely, he loses control of himself, which in the Victorian parlance, we would say he was unmanned, he's unmanned by this experience. He's, the policeman thinks he's drunk. He gets thrown into the drunk tank. Everyone's just like, what's your problem? Like, you're losing your cool, man. Get with it. You know, and so this whole experience, what it has done is it's almost like it's given him a taste of what it's like to be a woman
right.
in this time period, because he feels that sense of like lack of control. And what it causes him to do is treat his girlfriend with more humanity and respect.
Right.
And like, of course, today, and this is where the context is so important, today, like, what's the big deal, you know, with like them getting married? Like, who cares?
Yeah.
There's a lot of protection and power that is in that time period that is engendered onto a woman if the person who is having sex with her is also respecting her enough to say, I'm going to provide legal protection to you and financial protection. And so obviously today, you know, that's outdated, but that doesn't mean that when that story was written, that there wasn't more substance to getting married than just like, you know, not being a prude or being prudish.
Yeah.
You know, it's more than just being prudish. What he's saying is, I'm not like also doing this with 16 other people around town. And if you find yourself in a family way, you're out of luck.
Right.
You know, what he's saying is, I'm committing to you. I will protect you. I will, you know, enfranchise you, you know. Yeah. And so he ceases treating her like this thing to like treat like a toy, and feels the value of her life and the value of, you know, it's so interesting. He sees the value of this stranger's life, the girl who ends up getting murdered. He's devastated by it.
Yeah.
And it's just so interesting. Like, you know, we're into this discussion and we really haven't talked too much about like, well, who do we think did it? It doesn't matter.
That's not, yeah, that isn't the point at all. I think to your point, there's an uncharacteristic amount of pathos in this story.
Yes.
Because I've read hundreds of stories like this one. But what stands out is like this main character truly is devastated at the end of this story, which is something that we do not see in other places. And I think you're right. If this were a male writer from this period in time, I think he would have concluded the story with like a, whew, we dodged a bullet.
Yeah,
see what happened, bullet. Right? And there wouldn't be the same level of grief, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So with regards to that level of grief, again, I feel like this opens up a deeper allegorical reading too, where it gives us kind of a more universal experience. Do you feel like there's a statement in this story being made too about like society in London at the turn of the century? I keep coming back to like what's so important about so many of these writers is like they were living in this age of rapid industrialization, rapid social change, you know, a feeling at times that the world is changing faster than you can keep up with, right?
Yeah, sounds familiar.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I think that this is one of the reasons why modernist literature is so interesting, because I think it was preoccupied with the same ideas. But I don't want to forget Victorian literature in this conversation either, because I think that they share many of the same anxieties. And perhaps through an exposure to these anxieties, you know, we can better understand or put our finger on exactly what it is that gives us so much discomfiture as we go about our day-to-day lives, right? This guy knew what was going to happen, but was powerless to stop it, right? Mm-hmm. What happens to the many of us in our situations where, you know, we can see, for example, like an economic crash coming, right? We can see the difficulty down the road that is just waiting for us. And does it matter if, for example, we know a housing crash is coming, but we end up at, you know, seated in a house? Like, do we not feel the same sense of anxiety for the people who don't have that security, who don't have that ability to kind of insulate themselves from a crash that may be coming or from whatever it is, right?
Well, it's interesting to me. I mean, it's so, Michael, I know you said last we talked about like trending ideas in the last episode. And I think what this story shows, because we're drawing those parallels between the turn of the century last, you know, that last century, and then what we're going through now in this century.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing these ideas. I think these ideas trend, and then we drop off on the discussion like after 10 days or whatever, because yeah. people don't realize that these are recurring themes. These are themes that have happened mm-hmm. over and over and over again.
And over and over.
And that's why they just kind of drop off. But I feel like they're yeah. you know, they stop and just look, and we can say, no, this is stuff we've struggled with for centuries. And
yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. talk about your relevancy.
Yeah.
Right?
Like, yeah.
I think when I read this story last night, because forgive me, you know, I don't, I'm rather new to some of this stuff, and this story was mm-hmm. new for me.
You're still working through your Star Wars update 1996.
Don't talk about Star Wars. let's talk about Edith Nesbitt. It's so much better than Star Wars. I mean, what struck me as I was reading this story last night was just like, golly, man, do I feel like Nesbitt just like understood her moment, right? That cultural
yeah.
moment.
Yeah. Oh,
and,
yeah.
And how much I still resonate with her work, you know, for this reason, right? Like, I really enjoyed this story because I think it's almost like built to withstand a test of time, right? It's built on this kind of like preoccupation that I think is very universally human, mm-hmm. especially in you know, this like rapid modernizing age. Maybe it mm-hmm. won't be as recognizably resonant, you know, in 300 years where we're all on spaceships, you know, in like a
yeah.
post scarcity universe. I don't know. but I think right now it feels really resonant.
Yeah. And I mean, you take out like maybe 6 or 7 references and you have zero idea what time period this is in. It could easily be in modern London.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of these stories are surprisingly, like, there are things that date them, but because the focus is on character development, there's not a lot. It's not like I'll give kind of a funny example. As you know, a person who was born in the late 80s, I absolutely love Arrested Development. I think it's such a funny show. But you, like, if I were to play that to a Gen Zer, they would still think it was funny. The people were funny, but so many of the references are built around like the Bush years,
right?
And there's just so much stuff that like would be lost on them. And it doesn't make it like not a fantastic, hilarious show, but it does mean that it is dated.
Right.
And I think there's that tension between something that's classic and universal and something that's fashionable. I think fashionable things are important. And we need to, like, if something's fashionable, it's for a reason. It's addressing the present moment. I think that's critical. But I think that these stories like this that have a more of a universal appeal, they're going to pass on much further than, say, like, I've read Victorian stories that are super dated, you know, and yeah. and that you're just like, well, like, I just can't get into this because it's all about, you know, like the silver crisis of right. the late 1800s. You know, like, yeah, yeah. I don't care about whether your economy works on silver or gold. That's boring, you know. But a story like this could be set in any decade, really.
Yeah
absolutely. Definitely. Well,
so let's transition gears. Let's talk yeah. about M.R. Yeah. James, which was the second story we looked at.
So I gotta say, when I'm reading Lost Hearts, the first, so I don't know if you've listened to our podcast before or anything, we did a five part series on Bram Stoker and Dracula, where mm-hmm. I feel like we covered a lot of information, but we still just kind of skimmed
the surface,
like yeah. scratched the surface. And in that, we get into Bram Stoker's life in like 2 episodes, and we talk about the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, and we get really,
oh, yeah.
really involved yes. with that. So I'm reading M.R. James, especially that it's published in 1895, and I'm reading this old mm-hmm. man, and that's what pops in my head is the Hermetic Order of the
totally.
Golden Dawn.
We gotta be real careful about how we talk about this stuff, for the Slay siblings are gonna come after us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you wanna
Oh, go ahead.
I was just gonna say, do you wanna give us a little lowdown into this story too, like you yeah. did for the last one?
So a little bit of background on Emmer James, like why we've been talking about him like he's such a big deal is because in the UK especially, he's just considered the absolute master of the ghost story. Ghosts are very different from, say, Henry James, an American, who's famous for The Turn of the Screw, or you know, Charles Dickens, because his ghosts have this extremely visceral, almost zombie-like quality that is very different from the way the ghosts were. Definitely. If you think about Victorian ghost stories, you do kind of tend to think about like a hazy, misty vision, and these are not that way at all.
And James was one of the
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, James is one of the characters that was in that organization, wasn't he? Wasn't he a part of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn?
He was not. Okay. But he was definitely privy to it.
Right.
He would have been very serious about something like that. And he also kind of lampooned it in a story that's also really famous called Casting the Runes. So he would have been one of those people who's like, that's not a joke. I wouldn't screw around with that. He always said, like, when asked, like, do you believe in ghosts? He always said, I'm open to evidence. You know, he wasn't like a true believer, but he was like, you shouldn't screw around with this stuff because something's working here. So
that's my partner's response. Anytime we, you know, talk about like a Ouija board or something like that, it's like,
yeah,
no man, don't fuck with that.
No. Like,
yeah, he would have a similar thing where he's like, I don't understand it. I'm not saying I'm a true believer, but I'm just out. Nope. So the character, the villain in this story is definitely, you're right, he's modeled after these folks who were really into a resurgence in black magic, which was very fashionable in kind of the higher upper echelons of educated British society. You know, they were kind of like, well, we're done with Christianity, but we also have a taste for the occult. And spiritualism was really wildly popular, especially with the middle class. And so this like dark magic was ironically kind of very popular with the upper classes. And so I'll get into the gist here, but Lost Hearts was his second story that he wrote. And a lot of people, myself included, would say it's probably one of his darkest. It's very dark.
Oh, super dark. Yeah.
So like all M.R. James stories, this takes place in the past, and there's kind of a telescopic approach to it, that you're hearing it from a person who heard it from a person who you know, heard it from a firsthand witness many years ago.
And this was a very popular model, right? Or framing device.
He did
device
that a lot in a lot of his stories.
I think it was like a very popular framing device for a lot of horror writers time, right? Like it gives an air of
authenticity.
Like credence. Yeah, yeah, authenticity, right? Mm-hmm.
Like, well, even Henry James does it at the beginning of A Turn of the Screw. They're all sitting around telling ghost stories, and one's like...
I love that you point that out, because no one remembers that. Everyone forgets the framing device to turn the screw.
I love
but
that.
Yeah, like there's this telescope that I heard it from a guy, like, or I got the manuscript from the guy who wrote it, and he died. And that's another thing with M.R. James, is a lot of times these people, it's like, well, they die. There's a creepiness about it. It's like, they're dead now, and I have their story. Yeah. You know? So this is a thing that happened. And you might have the date in front of you. I don't. I think 1895 might be.
It was 1895. Yep.
Okay. So the story set in 1811, and I don't know if I'd say protagonist. Yeah, protagonist is the right word. The guy we're following is a 12-year-old orphan named Stephen Elliott, who just lost his parents, and he's been sent off to live with his middle-aged bachelor cousin, who's called Mr. Abney. And Abney is this eccentric hermit who is he's like kind of a sometimes professor of Greek at Cambridge, and is really into esoteric Greco-Roman metaphysics. And he has all these references,
like you do,
but like, it's just, when it comes to James, there's just so many footnotes, because he talks about, you know, he's into the mysteries and the Orphic poems and the worship of Mithras and the Neoplatonists and all this stuff. That's like, what are you
talking
about?
So much symbology, like just condensed in these stories. he really lays it on thick.
Yeah. So he's a guy who's really into Greco-Roman dark arts, which is interesting, because we're not talking about pagan arts in the sense of, you know, like, we're not talking about Wiccan. We're talking about Greco-Roman dark arts. It's a different right. It's a different animal. So Stephen shows up at his mansion in the country, and his cousin, he's a real creepy guy. He's an older guy who's very weird and very eccentric, but comes off like very warm. He just asks lots of weird questions, like he's really curious about his birthday, and is like creepily pleased to find out that he is 12 years old. He's like, oh, that's great, that's perfect, that'll be perfect.
It's
for me
the right age. Like, okay.
I'll let you guys know, I aspire to be that uncle to my nephews yeah. and nieces.
Yeah, I mean, this, like, honestly, this story reads a lot. It starts out a lot like a Charles Dickens novel.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, and he could be kind of a like, not a villain, but kind of just a tedious person who, you know, grinds down on this poor orphan boy, you know, but he's not. He's a full out villain. He's a bad guy. You know, he ushers him in, and he's done with him. Then he goes off and introduces right. him to the housekeeper and the butler. And the housekeeper's name is Mrs. Bunch, and she helps him get moved in. And Stephen's this really interesting kid. He's very philosophical, and he has all these weird questions. He asks his own weird yeah. questions, kind of like Abney does. But he wants to know, you know, is Mr. Abney a good man, and will he go to heaven one day?
Yes.
And kind of, again, M.R. James is really famous for his humor. Especially after you've read the story, some of these interactions are kind of darkly humorous. Yeah. But she's like, oh, he's such a good man, and of course he'll go to heaven. You know, she tells him about how, well, you know, it was only recently that he took in this poor Romani girl. You know, they girl. Call her a gypsy, but yeah. You know, they would say a Romani. This poor orphaned Romani girl who... you know, didn't have any kith or kin, took her in. But it's so interesting. She lived with us for 3 weeks, and then she vanished.
Yeah, you know? She's just like, I wonder what happened to that little girl.
So yeah. And then Mrs. Bunch assumes, you know, she blames it on the Romani people. She says, right. well, she must have been, which is so funny. She must have been stolen by gypsies, which is, that was a trope in the day
yeah.
of like, if a child disappeared, well, maybe they were kidnapped by gypsies. And it's like, is a Romani. Like, obviously they might come for their own person, but her implication is like, well, yeah. those people, they kidnap children. Yeah. So they must have kidnapped.
It's the 19th century version of the dingo ate your baby.
Yes. Yeah. Dingo ate my baby. Yeah, yeah exactly. Yeah. So, Then she points out, well, this is actually that was the first time he did something like this. Actually, shortly after that, there was an Italian boy named his name's Giovanni, but she calls him Giovanni because James
that's right.
James likes to write in the vernacular, so yeah. he throws in this kind of country English accent that she has. Giovanni, who came to their door one winter day, and he was playing his hurdy-gurdy, which you can look that up on YouTube if you don't know what that is. But it's kind of a cool instrument that makes a very, it's kind of a creepy, it's kind of a creepy bagpipey sound.
Yeah.
But it's a stringed instrument, and he was playing it asking for, you know, some alms. And Abney was like, oh, no, just live with us. You just live with us now. And he also...
Do it. Hurdy-gurdy.
It's funny because he also sticks around for a little bit. And then also disappears.
He vanishes too.
Without his hurdy-gurdy.
Damn, like, gypsies.
Leaving this instrument, which was not just like a very cherished cultural right. token, but it's also his source of income. But basically, Abney's great. He's awesome. He takes an orphan, and they just happen to disappear.
He loses more orphans than I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Missing orphans, he's a great guy.
Yeah, so now this older cousin is on his third orphan, Stephen.
He's worse than Batman.
Yeah. And so Stephen's sitting there, and he's kind of like, well, you know, interesting. I'm taking note of that. And he's such an interesting character because throughout the story, he takes notes of things, and he never reacts really intensely.
Right.
He just absorbs it, and you never know what he's thinking, really. Well, shortly after that, one of the creepiest scenes in all of M.R. James, it's so cinematic and so creepy. A few nights after that, he has a dream that he's walking down the corridor in the upper stories where his bedroom is, and he's walking down the corridor to this bathroom that has a leaded pane, a leaded glass pane, so you can't mm-hmm. see him, but you can see light, and he can tell there's some kind of a light in it. And he opens the door, and the window has been pulled back, and there's moonlight pouring into the bathtub. Mm-hmm. And in the bathtub, he sees a shriveled, almost mummified, zombie-like little girl who's holding her hands over her chest yeah. and like looks up at him pathetically. And then in a snapshot, like he suddenly wakes up, and the creepy, oh, it's so creepy. He wakes up. And he's standing in front of the bathroom.
Yeah.
You know, the dream is over, but he's standing in front of the bathroom door. There's no light coming in, but, you know, he checks it out, and thankfully the bathtub is empty. And so he's like, well, that was kind of weird. You know, oh, just moving on. And that's part of Stephen's character, is that, like, he's either extremely intelligent or he's very stupid. And I think James, knowing James's personality, I think he wants to leave that up to our interpretation, because he had kind of his relationship with children was always kind of funny. There wasn't any hanky panky about it. He wasn't like a person that you wouldn't want to be teaching your right. child, but he always had kind of a sense of loving teaching kids, but also thinking, you know, having kind of like, I want to kick him in, you know, the seat of the pants to scoot him along, kind of an approach to children.
Yeah.
So, and a lot of these stories were very popular with children at the time, but moving on. So another night he wakes up and his nightshirt's been like weirdly torn.
Yeah.
There's some parallel slits over the left side of his chest, like an animal had scratched him with its claws, but his flesh isn't scratched. It's just the shirt. And he tells Mrs. Bunch about that. And as he goes up to talk to her, he overhears her talking to the butler, and the butler is nervous because he's heard voices talking in the wine cellar,
mm-hmm.
and says he's not going to do that anymore. He's not going to go to the wine cellar. But Bunch is like, oh, you're just drunk because you've been sampling the wine. But so we have these two like really creepy moments that suggest something is cooking here, and I think we can kind of tell where this is going. Which is classic of James. He wants to drop hints, but he holds off for a big reveal.
Oh yeah.
So on the story meets its apex on March 4th of the following year, or March 24th of the following year, which is a significant date. And Abney tells Stephen, you know, hey, little cousin, I would love to meet you at 11 p.m. in my study because I have something very important to show you, but don't tell Mrs. Bunch and don't tell the butler, you know, So, you know, already this is sounding not great. You know, it's like, why do you have to wait until then? Why can't I tell them what's going on? But Stephen respects his request. And, you know, an hour before the appointment, he kind of gets ready and he stands out at the window from his bedroom that's looking out over the front yard. And the yard is just completely awash with mm-hmm. moonlight. And he can kind of, he can see everything and he feels like he's hearing some strange cries
mm-hmm.
and wails and moans floating over the air, but they seem to be getting like closer and closer. But then all of a sudden the sounds stop and he's about to go back to bed, but he looks down at the front yard and he sees a boy and a girl standing in the front yard looking back at him.
Nope.
And the girl is she resembles the figure he saw in the bathtub.
Yeah, she's got her hands very, over very her sad. Heart. Right?
Yeah, she's very sad and pathetic. And
the kid, I was gonna say the kid too, has the same like marks, right? On the same side where where Stephen's garment was rent, right? The kid has like these dark black marks on his body.
Yeah, so the girl is hiding her heart, the side of her chest where her heart is. So we assume there's something that she's covering up, and she's very sad. The boy is ferocious, you know, like where she is pathetic, he's ferocious, and he's holding his hands up.
In the sky.
One of those classic James lines, he says, you can the something like the nails were terribly long and the moon shone through them.
Yeah.
You know, and you can just picture them, these nails glowing in the moonlight because the moon's behind them. And he's exposing his chest, and there's a black rent.
Yes.
Where like the chest cavity has been torn open and the heart has been removed.
I'm looking at your picture now, and you capture all of that really well in that picture. Mm. It's really great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's such a cinematic, creepy moment.
It's visceral.
And so, you would think, hey, that's not great. Like something's going on here. But Stephen, he sticks with his appointment. He goes down to Abney's study at 11 o'clock, but the door's jammed and he can hear people talking inside. And then all of a sudden he hears Abney scream, the strangled cry. And you know, when the servants get there and the door's been open, Stephen pops in and sees Abney on his chair with there's a long knife on the side table, mm-hmm. and a large glass of wine and some kind of a manuscript where Abney has spelled out his religious beliefs and his plans for Stephen.
Yeah.
But Abney's sitting there with his chest has been torn open, presumably by the boy's long fingernails, and his heart is still there. So it's one of the, not to jump into the analysis, but it's really interesting because Abney's been harvesting these hearts. But when the children claim revenge on them, their approach is to expose his heart. So they don't want to take it. They want people to, this is his heart. This is, you know, this man is evil.
Yeah.
But essentially what happens at the end is Stephen, you know, takes these papers and it takes him a while to understand them because he's so young. But in the conclusion, Stephen explains to the narrator, who's now telling this to us, that in this manuscript, Abney spelled out like his study of the Greco-Roman mystery religions and how essentially he found this ritual where you could, in his words, gain a complete ascendancy over those orders of spiritual beings which control the elemental forces of our universe. So it's a fancy way of saying you can like become a superhero.
Right.
Like,
I can get powers. Invisible.
Yeah, you get all these powers.
Yeah.
You just and in the papers,
murder three
he
children.
He talks about, in the papers, he talks about how at this date, for the last 2 years, which is, it's close to the spring solstice, or the spring equinox.
Right.
It's close to that point. The previous year, he had an Italian boy, Giovanni Paoli, who he, you know, killed and harvested his heart. Yep. The year before that, it was Phoebe Stanley was the name of the girl who was a quote unquote gypsy, and he harvested her heart, and he just needs a third victim. And he writes in his notes that like, well, this must be my cousin. March 24th. Yeah. And he, you know, he says like in his notes, you know, he suffered some annoyance from ghosts, but he says, you know, essentially a smart, intelligent, well-trained man shouldn't be bothered by that. It's not a big deal. They can't hurt you, but obviously they can. So that's the end of the story. You know, essentially he, in his notes, he's admitted, I've been murdering children, hoping that I can gain eternal life and, you know, an ability to like become invisible and fly and all this goofy stuff.
Yeah.
But it's such a, and it ends without us really knowing what happens to Stephen, other than like he apparently survived long enough to pass story on to the narrator.
Yeah.
But it's another one of these stories where surprisingly the focus is not on, you know, like some great, you know, African hunter who, in the sense of like a colonialist, mm-hmm. who's going to like flush out the demons of, you know, the Dark Continent or anything like that. It's told from the perspective of a foreigner, a girl, you know, a young girl who has been orphaned, and a little boy who's been orphaned. So these are all three characters. All the victims are people who are extremely marginalized in the society. Orphans, all three, you know, a gypsy and an Italian immigrant. And these are the characters that Abney, who represents, you know, the upper echelons of Cambridge society, has been, you know, victimizing. So it's interesting, but, you know, it's not a story that's going to, you know, really aggrandize the imperial ethos. It's something that's kind of pointing out the dark underbelly of it.
Yeah.
Well, you make a really great point. And I want to jump on this real quick. Because like I said, I like to talk about craft, and you make this really great point that we don't know if Steven is stupid or if he's really intelligent. And yeah. Like, we also don't know necessarily what's going on in the head of the guy in the first story either. I mean, he kind of reacts and responds, but what's fascinating about both of these stories that they're in that perspective, that POV is like that close third person, that free and direct style,
yes.
Because it's still the he said, she said, but we're following one character really closely. But what they mm-hmm. do brilliantly in this is that they refuse to tell us if this character, because I mean, like a lot of first year writers and programs and stuff, their inclination would be in writing a story like this would be like, oh, I'm going to tell you if he's stupid or intelligent.
Yeah.
And it's like,
absolutely.
No, we follow him and we see the world through his eyes, but we don't have to hear his reasoning because that's just not how people think.
I think it's an interesting point too. When I read the story, you know, I thought as this kid was, you know, asking these questions of his uncle, you know, I felt like a part of it was like the kid's trying to figure out where he stands.
Yeah.
Right. He's trying to figure mm-hmm. out who this uncle is and like, you know, am I going to have a good time here? Am I going to have a bad time here?
Yeah.
You know, like it. And so to that end, I feel like it spoke to me of a real intelligence, right?
Yeah.
Because
this
kid is cognizant of the space that he's in and what very little agency he has. And so he's trying to suss out like, and kind of like order himself in these mm-hmm. affairs where he's trying to figure out where do I fit in, you know, the pecking order of this house, like what kind of a life am I going to be living here? And really mm-hmm. like what, you know, what's the outcome here? What's going to happen with me?
Yeah.
Well, and we see his reasoning too, because like, I think you pointed out, Michael, in one of your annotations, that the kid, I feel like, picks up because the uncle doesn't know if it's like tea time or if it's dinner time. Like when the kid first mm-hmm. arrives, he's like, I don't know what, you know, what's proper for you to eat right now. And I feel like Steven kind of picks up on that, like, hey, you know, shouldn't he know what I need to be?
Well, and that's an interesting point too, to the uncle, because the uncle's a jackass, right? Like he has no real concept of what this kid needs. You know, he's like, oh, great, Steven, I'm so glad you're here. Here's my maid. She'll take care of
everything. Yeah, she'll
figure
it out.
You know? mm-hmm. Yeah. He just kind of like passes him off. And
he kind of reminds me of Count Olaf in the series of unfortunate events.
Yes. Yeah,
definitely.
Very similar.
I think to the, you know, the point about craft too, what we get about this character, I think is all in the subtext of how the story is structured.
Yeah.
Right. We know that there's something freaking off about this uncle almost from mm-hmm. the get-go, from the way that he interacts with Steven. And as Steven points these questions to Mrs. Bunch and says stuff like, is he a good person? You think he's going to go to heaven? Like, immediately my response as a reader is like, nope.
You know, like you don't have to ask that. Yeah, if he is a good person.
Yeah, we're given an opportunity, I think, to learn more about who this guy is and what he's doing. Just, you know, contextually through the story itself. Yeah. I think this is a masterclass of that old adage of like, show don't tell.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right?
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. And I think M.R. James does a lot of showing instead of telling.
Yeah,
there's
he sure does.
There's a point where like the kid Steven is pointing out, I think it's Steven who points it out. He says like, there are some weird scratches on the wall over here.
Yep. Yes.
Yep. You know, and Mrs. Bunch is like, well, that's weird. Like, they're not at a level with like an animal or something. She's like, I should probably maybe check out what's going on. you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Steven's incredibly intelligent, but it is interesting how, in talking to other people who've read this story, sometimes you might get glib responses. I've even taught this story for a class, and you get some glib responses about like, well, why did he stay? which is a great opportunity to talk about, like, what is he going to do?
Can we
what
talk
choice
about...
does he have?
Yeah.
And that's the whole point of this, or not the point, because there's a lot of points being made. But one of the great points of the story is, like, when you live in a society where you are marginalized, I mean, it doesn't matter that he's a white male. He's a white male orphan who's underage.
Right. Right.
Who doesn't have, like, I mean, he has a benefactor, but he doesn't have an independent source of income.
Right.
So he's still on the same level as, you know, a foreign child and a child who is, I suppose we could say, a cultural minority, you know, a member of the Romani people. These are all three children who have no say in the world and are kind of tossed about by the whims of the adults who can choose to protect them, or to, you know, to do stuff with them that, I mean, again, just like with the previous story, there's a lot of sexual subtext here that's very uncomfortable to think about, you know, because it's extremely violative the way the Abney, you know, uses these children. And there's definitely a lot here that that is just really sad to think about, like what this could really be talking about.
Yeah.
But you just think, this is a man who was able to do this because of his station in life and because people viewed him as a source of authority.
Yeah.
You know, so once again, one of the things I will always champion about the Victorian ghost story is that not all stories are good. But just because a story is old doesn't mean that it's somehow, you know, going to be something that's very deplorable, you know, or racist or sexist. Like, this is a story which, in spite of the author who is, you know, coming from Cambridge and a place of authority and a place of, you know, he's part of that imperial project, he's still sitting down and writing a story that points out the costs that that kind of a society can have on people who aren't part of that project. And it's a deeply sad story, but also unforgettable. You can't forget some of those scenes. So cinematic.
Well, and I think, again, coming to the relevancy of this story, you know, and the multiple readings we can perform for it, you know, on the one hand, there is the reading about agency again, right?
Yeah.
You know, you talk about the kids who are like, well, why didn't he just leave? Like, what what choice do you
what
have
choice?
When you're 12 years old? You know, like, I'm 35, and people, you know, when I see people talking about issues of economic inequality or something like that, you know, the trouble that a lot of millennials are having with, like, finding well-paying jobs or good-paying jobs or jobs with the kind of benefits that can sustain you, you know, there's this conversation like, well, why don't you just leave your company? Like, it's like fucking easy to just leave a company, you know?
Yeah, what's your option, you know?
Right.
Yeah. Hopefully you maybe find something better, but you don't, that's not a guarantee.
Right. And I have more privilege than most, right? I have several advanced degrees. I have a lot more mobility probably than other people. And it's still a daunting task to try to figure out, you know, where would I go? What would happen if I had less education? You know, I had less of that privilege. So there's a reading of privilege and agency in this story that I think is really important, because, again, to your point, you know, we are talking about marginalized kids. Which I think, you know, just kind of stacks more and more and more of that, like, inability to be, you know, socially or economically mobile, right?
Yeah.
I think, too, there's also a reading of the kind of, like, vampirism of the rich, right? The vampirism of, you know, these people of power, right? It's significant that these are marginalized groups, right? We have a poor Italian kid. We have a Romani girl, which I think if you want to talk about a marginalized community in England, what better group to talk about than a Romani person? I think if we had translated this from you know, British society to American society, that little girl would be black, or that little girl would be Native American, right? Like, those would be the marginalized groups that that these characters would represent, you know, in the American landscape. So we have this rich white dude who's literally, you know, just taking these people in because it's convenient for him, for his, you know, his like machinations for power, right?
Right.
Yeah. And I think read in a modern context, even, I mean, how different is it that this guy, you know, just takes these kids in to cut out their hearts so he can learn black magic or whatever, you know, like, I don't know. Maybe it's just me in this unique cultural moment. It's like, you know, now we have billionaires who are just like buying social media platforms.
Yeah.
You know, how is that any different? Right. It's like,
wait a minute, Trevor, to whom are you referring?
Well, it's certainly not a musky guy or anything.
Yeah. I'm sure he smells fine.
Yeah. You know, I think that there's, I don't think that it's all that different, right? Like, we're just kind of translating the ideas. The allegory here, I think, is still, you know, this preoccupation of like these people with means, these people with power, you know, continue to consume these other marginalized groups in order to consolidate their own power. They're not interested in charity. They're not interested in doing the right thing. They're only interested in the things that allow them to consolidate more of their power for themselves. And I think in a way it's kind of quaint to be like, well, here's this really rich dude who's just into black magic. Like, how nice would it be if our billionaires today were just like, man, I'm really into crystals, you know, like instead of fucking, I'm going to take over the world through the information that you get from social media, you know?
I now picture like Mark Zuckerberg walking up with like a crystal being like, you can't tip me over. You can't tip me over.
Sounds about right.
Yeah.
Well, the causes and stuff might have changed, but it does speak topically to like the billionaires and the things they, you know.
I mean, whenever I see a dude like this who definitely would have been in the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, right? Like that Hermetic Order, again, like not to speak too ill of them because of the Slice siblings, but, you know, like... I these are the movers and shakers, right? Like these are the people in the world that you know had real power, had real influence, and look at the way that they shaped. I mean, even conversations about culture. I mean, look at the way that they created stories that have lasted for generations and shaped public consciousness about things, right? These are not individuals in this Hermetic Order who, you know, were just like, oh yeah, this is my I don't know, this is my bingo club, you know, like
carried over into their personal and professional lives,
right? They had real goals and were really doing things, shaping public discourse, shaping politics, and I think that
to the point that, like you said, I mean, M.R. James wasn't a part of this, but he knew of it and he was intimate with it.
Yeah.
And that was the question I think we raised from our research with like Bram Stoker. It's like there was there were points that said Bram Stoker was a part of it, and then there was evidence to show that maybe he wasn't, but he was really intimate.
Right.
Either way, it fully impacted like his life.
Yeah. Well, and
they were in that circle.
Yeah, you were talking too about what was her name? Madame Z.
Madame Blavatsky.
Oh, Madame Blavatsky.
Yeah, Blavatsky.
Whose ideas were so prominent, right? Were so prevalent that, you know, it there's like a definite through line between that and Nazism, right? Yeah. Like the eugenics and you know all of those ideas that I think cropped up around Nazism. These people, right, have a political agency and have a way of shaping events, shaping discourse in a way. I'm not talking just like weird Illuminati shit. You know, I'm talking like historical record. They shaped discourse.
They shaped world history.
Events, world history.
Like Rasputin with the Russians and the Tsars. I mean, that was all.
And I think what M.R. James kind of points out in this story is how predatory these people are.
Yes.
Or at least can be, right?
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting thing that runs through his work, because again, he was a member of that circle of, you know, Cambridge elites, but his stories are consistently very, like, surprisingly populist. You know, they are they're very skeptical and suspicious of powerful individuals who use their individual wealth to cancel out collective traditions. So, you know, a lot of times there'll be a story about like a rich guy who decides to like demolish a cathedral to put up something that's more fashionable, and he accidentally releases a vampire, you know, that was hidden under the crypts. Yeah. And so like, that's why that community, which, you know, usually it's this alliance between working class people, tradesmen, and clerics, or, you know, the lawyers, the middle class college educated people in that community, where they're kind of in an alliance of like, oh, you know, we have varying degrees of understanding about what's going on here, but don't screw with the crypt, you know. And then some rich Oxford educated architect comes in and is like, ah, we're gonna throw that all away, it's pointless. And then a plague settles on the whole town. This whole thing is a reference to a story called An Episode of Cathedral History, but there's a lot of other stories that he writes that are like it, where the recurring theme is, you know, just because you, and it makes so much sense, and in terms of the reference that you just made about, you know, Twitter, let's put it that way, just because you have a whim that like this is how things should be doesn't mean you should steamroll over the collective good. Mm-hmm. You know, because you can afford to, and we do that because we have collective traditions and collective needs and securities that shouldn't be at the whim of the person who just happens to have the most financial or cultural power.
Yeah, yep. Absolutely.
Yep.
So I give big kudos to M.R. James, you know, as much as he was a part of that community of, you know, college educated elites, his stories very consistently do kind of, you know, point to some of the uncomfortable truths that people in that society would have been a little bit shy to talk about. And I think part of it was because he was a little bit of an eccentric and a renegade, and was also very lazy. And he didn't have the ambition that a lot of those guys had. He's like, I just want to read, you know, I want to read like ancient medieval manuscripts and be left alone. And he was always very annoyed with these ambitious up and comers. You know, who like to say like, well, we're going to throw all this crap out and we're going to make it up to date and modern. And he's like, but at what cost? Like, you're doing that because it makes you look good or progresses your career. But think about all the hundreds and thousands of millions of people you're disadvantaging by steamrolling stuff in the name of your quote unquote progress.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, exactly.
And I think that's why we need to read these Victorian stories. I feel like, yeah. I mean, there's that, because there is that parallel between their society and ours, and yeah. we can draw that parallel, I think, to most time periods, but what's very particular about these time periods is that like you said earlier, their world, or Trevor maybe, their world was rapidly changing, and our world is rapidly changing, just in a different way, but we are experiencing that same kind of paradigm shift in culture that they did, and that's what especially makes their stories so relevant today.
Yeah, absolutely. If there is a thesis statement for this episode, right, as we kind of come to a close, I think the thesis statement really is like, these old stories can still reveal so much to us about our society today and our place in society today. Because I think that the human concerns we have not changed in a post-industrial world, right? Yeah. I think that instead, as long as these same systems that were being built, you know, a century and a half ago or whatever, you know, these same systems have not changed all that much. And I think that human lives within these systems have not changed all that much. Yep. So that even though we may have perhaps different material circumstances or different cultural circumstances right now, you know, I think that our human concerns and the interaction of human to human, right, continues to follow along a parallel path, a mirrored path, right? And I think that these stories can help us understand and contextualize our moment and perhaps push us, you know, closer toward taking action that maybe mm-hmm. leads to a more equitable, less horrific future.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well put.
Here's hoping in 100 years, too, that there is a podcast or whatever is popular at that time talking about us and all of us. And that's
we nailed it.
Man, Michael, I want to say thank you so much for giving us your time. This has been really awesome talking to you. And
absolutely. And, likewise.
And just really kind of getting that out there. I love these episodes.
I think what's mm-hmm. great about them is that we're idiots like 99% of the time. And then someone comes in and like helps us elevate our discourse entirely.
So yeah, that makes us be serious. So silly. Yeah.
It was absolutely a pleasure talking with you guys, and I'll be happy to come back anytime.
Absolutely. Are you going to be in StokerCon this year or do you ever?
I won't, yeah. But definitely I look forward to seeing what comes from that and, you know, some of the conversations and news and updates that pop out of that.
Well, we are going to be there, so we will keep you informed about what's going on, and we're excited, man. This has been really great talking to you. We really appreciate it.
You too. Take care, guys.
All right. Awesome. You too.
See you. Thank you.